Okay, everyone. Well, it's so good to have you here. This is kind of the end of the road, isn't it, for some of you? I'm going to be here again tomorrow morning for a post-forum. We're going to be talking in the post-forum about the transforming culture aspects of what it is that I'm really committed to. I was sharing with my network this morning that I have been provided a unique platform among Christian ministries because of what it is that I've been able to do in helping these ministries raise money. And most ministries relate more quickly to their need for money than they do for their desire to transform culture, because they somehow have lost the perhaps a little bit of the vision for transforming culture for the lack of money that prohibits them from really being able to think about ministry. They're thinking more about survival than they are about what it is that God's called them to do. And I think that's pretty understandable. You know, the lack of money can cause you to change focus pretty quickly. But tomorrow I'd like to talk about specifically about how, you know, the principles that we've been talking about, the developmental principles that we can talk about or have been talking about, can essentially be utilized in some very, very practical ways in church ministries and organizational ministries to not only transform the lives of people, which is obviously the goal that we have through redemption in Christ and through edification and so forth, to equip and train, that how we can transform culture. I had this interesting meeting at lunch with a Sopron participant who expressing his level of frustration, I think, with the fact that we have, you know, in the world today, a relatively small percentage of those who would have a homosexual perspective on relationships, and how that relatively small percentage of people has really dictated, in many respects, you know, a transformation in the attitudes of the general populace around the world as it relates to their alternative lifestyle, which we would find to be, you know, definitely counter to what it is that the Bible teaches. But how does, and yet we represent such a significant majority, relatively speaking, in terms of the role that we play in society, but do we impact culture to the extent, you know, that some other groups do? And what's the difference? And so we spent a good time this afternoon over lunch just discussing what that difference was. My conclusion is that, you know, most evangelicals don't have a plan. You know, they don't have, they know what it is that they want to do, and they when they see it not happening, they're very aware of the fact that it doesn't exist. But when it comes to, well, what's our plan to counter what it is that's taking place, you know, that depravity is bringing to the table, they haven't the foggiest idea how to deal with that. And I think that's really the issue that we need to grapple with today in the church is, do we have a plan, and do we have an organizational structure to be able to address that plan? That's kind of what it is that we're talking about in this session, is organization. Because, you know, when we hear about opportunities, you know, be it in relationship to transforming culture, or more specifically in relationship to basic core issues that we need to address in terms of development. And we've been talking about those over the last several days here, either in the network or in this session in the afternoon. It almost can become, at one level, pretty overwhelming because, you know, we didn't come, you know, with a lack of things to do. We're certainly not leaving with a lack of things to do. In fact, we may feel in some respects that the plate's that much fuller than it was when we started. So how do we address the issues that we need to address and still maintain some level of sanity and focus in terms of what it is that God specifically has called us to do? And I think that's the issue that I want to talk about in terms of planning today. So if you have your notes, it's on page 26 that we're going to begin. And it's entitled Fourth Workshop Session, Organization for Development. And let me begin with a word of prayer, and then we'll devote our time to kind of thinking through some issues, and hopefully we'll have some opportunity to interact a little bit as it relates to how these issues can be applied practically in a variety of settings in which we may find ourselves. But let's pray together. Father in heaven, thank you for the day that you've given to us for the Sopron experience of 2004. And it's been a delightful one. It's been wonderful to be together with Christian leaders from throughout this area of the world and beyond, And we thank you for what it is that we've heard shared in the network sessions and the public plenary sessions, in the conversations that have taken place over dinner and lunch. And to worship together, that unity, that sense of belonging that we feel as part of the body of Christ. And so, Lord, we rejoice in that, and we thank you for the privilege of being a part of it. Now, Lord, I would pray that as we think through organization and the challenges that we face in getting done things, because the bottom line seems to be in how do we get done the things that we know we need to do. And so, Lord, I would pray that you would help us to kind of think through those things in a way that would be very, very productive and helpful and practical. And give us wisdom as we see principles unfold and in knowing how to apply them to the situations that are unique to our ministries. And to that end, we'll give you thanks, for we pray in your name. Amen. Some general rules that kind of underline, I'm going to talk about critical groups and some of the things that we mentioned in the notes, but before we do that, I think there are some rules that have some relevance to organization, and so I want to talk about some of those rules. I've given you some rules already, and if you might want to jot a note in terms of maybe one of the back. Do you need some notes here? Two. There you go. There's three. They're cheap. I don't want to carry them home. They're heavy. I'd like you just to jot down some rules, because these core rules kind of drive a lot of what it is we do developmentally. The first, you know, rule is one that we introduced to you a couple of days ago. It's called the rule of linkage. And the rule of linkage, simply stated, is that the closer someone is linked to you, there's a greater likelihood that they're going to support you. And we noticed that when we were looking at prospects, some of the prospects that we identified or some of the prospect groups that we identified were very, very closely linked to us. In other words, we call them nuclear prospects because they benefit directly from the services that we provide. And so based upon their association with us, we would expect that if given the opportunity to support us and given the ability and the interest to support us, that group of people would be far more likely to support us than, say, you know, a corporation or a business, despite the fact that it might be owned by a Christian businessman. But if that businessman didn't have any linkage to our organization, there's kind of a diminishing likelihood that he's going to really become actively involved. So there's linkage. The closer the linkage, the greater the likelihood. And we indicated that there are two kinds of linkage. There's what I call natural linkage, the kind of linkage that exists between, for instance, my sisters and I, and adopt or created linkage, the kind of linkage that could be created through, let's say, the adoptive process, if my parents had chosen to adopt a child and bring them into the family. So that's the difference between natural and created linkage. And there's always a challenge in development. It's kind of an underlying challenge, but the question becomes, how can I create linkage with groups of people with whom I don't have it naturally? Are there ways that I can look at a crowd of people with whom I don't have natural linkage and engage them in some meaningful way in what it is that I have committed myself to do as a ministry? Recognizing that to the degree that I'm successful in doing that meaningfully, then I increase potentially or exponentially the likelihood that they'll come forward at some point in time in the future and lock arms with me in helping me to accomplish the vision that I've committed myself to do. Then we talked a little bit about communication, you know, one-on-one. That's the best way to communicate to people. If you want someone to respond to you, the best thing you could do is go to them and ask them to consider what it is that you see as a need that they might have an interest in becoming involved in supporting. The further you remove yourself from that ideal, there's kind of a law of diminishing returns. You know, everybody begins praying for everybody else, and nobody seems to get the point. And that is the point, because if you want someone to become involved, then you really need to go to them and talk to them about what it is that you're thinking and ways in which they might be able to participate in what it is that you're doing. We talked a little bit about in the network this morning about two-on-one being better. and I think at one level that's probably true. You know, when we go to people as a pair, there seems to be a better impact. And I think that's because if we go together, we all, the two, kind of know why we came. In other words, we came for the purpose of soliciting someone's involvement or seeking ways to engage them in our ministry. And so we know why we came, and so the very presence of somebody else in the meeting kind of enhances accountability. We tend to do what it is that we came to do. When if we come alone, it's easy to kind of let some things slide because of either some nervousness on our part or some reluctance to be, you know, really forthright in engaging people or seeking to engage folks. I think there's another reason why two-on-one is best, and that is because one person may have closer linkage to the prospect than another. In other words, I might go with Michael to visit with one of his prospective donors, someone who's obviously shown some level of interest in the ministry that Michael's involved in, and Michael has never asked anybody for $50,000 or $100,000, and he'd like me to go with him. But I don't know the donor to the or the prospect to the extent that Michael does, so Michael brings me. He introduces, since he has linkage to the prospect, he introduces me to the prospect, and his linkage with the both of us gives me credibility and actually provides me the platform to be able to do what it is that Michael wanted me to do, and that is to share the ministry and to seek the participation or the involvement of the individual. I think a third advantage of two-on-one is that we can pray for each other. While one's talking, the other one can pray, and vice versa. And then a fourth reason is just for propriety issues. If we're dealing with someone, especially with someone of the opposite sex, it certainly seems to make an awful lot of sense to me to not put yourself in any kind of a situation that could be perceived by anyone as being improper or inappropriate. So I think, you know, in the world in which we live, given the tendency of people and so forth, it's certainly wise to be sensitive to those issues, you know, wise as serpents kinds of things and harmless as doves. There's another set of rules that have been typically dubbed rules of five, and there are any number of rules of five. There's actually lots of them. That's why they're called the rules of five. One rule of five is that you shouldn't go into a capital funding campaign within 5 years of the beginning of the previous one, which I think is kind of an interesting rule. A lot of organizations, especially in the U.S., we see it a lot in churches and in colleges and universities, that every 5 to 7 years there's a new campaign. You know, that's almost like it's clockwork. You know, one campaign starts, it finishes, and 2 years later another one's starting, and then it finishes. And it happens in churches, it happens in colleges. And the reason for that is that a developmental generation is 5 to 7 years in length. You were to go to a high school, for example, or and a high school would be a good example. If you were to go to the senior or the graduating class and you were to meet all the graduates and shake their hands and so forth and meet their families and all the associated contacts that they might have. And then if you were to come back 7 years later, for example, and meet the graduating class, it's a totally different group of people. Unless, of course, they're particularly slow students. I mean, the realities are you've got a whole new group of people. And if you stop and think about that, every 6 years or 7 years, there are more. If you're adding at a, say, a 10% increase on an annual basis in what I call the leading developmental indicators that we talked about the other day, if you're adding a 10% increase, your database and the numbers of donors and so forth that are engaged in supporting your annual fund effort, every 7 years or every 5 years, you have about a 62% increase in each one of those leading developmental indicators, which means that you now have more people new to your organization than you had, you know, 5 years before, which justifies, for all practical purposes, a new campaign. That means you've sustained or retained your old donors, but you've added a whole series of new ones who've never been involved in helping you to support the multidimensional aspects of your vision, which oftentimes a capital campaign will allow you to do. That's kind of an interesting rule, I think. There's another rule of five, which is the one that's particularly relevant to what it is we're talking about here today in terms of organization, and that's that you never should try to accomplish more than five primary objectives in conjunction with every major initiative in which you're going to be involved in. Let me repeat that, because it's not all that confusion, it's just a lot of words. You should never seek to accomplish more than 5 primary objectives in conjunction with every, you know, major initiative. So let's say that you've decided this year that one of the groups of people that you want to work with is pastors of churches in the area where your ministry provides its services. And so that becomes an initiative. It becomes a developmental initiative. This is a group of people that we really want to develop. We'll never try to accomplish more than 5 things in any given year. And it may be that with pastors you say, well, we'd like to create a pastor's advisory board, a group of pastors that periodically get together and listen to what it is that we're doing and advise us as it relates to how we might be more effectively or more effective in engaging congregations and so forth and what it is that we're doing. You might say that we want to have all pastors open up their church on a particular Sunday for a special emphasis on areas relating to the nature of the ministry that we're involved. I mean, there are any number of things that you could do, but limit it to 5. Don't try to skin the whole cat in one meal or eat the whole elephant, you know, at one sitting. But take it a step at a time, constantly working towards developing the kind of profiled relationship that you'd like to have with those individuals. Now, an important starting point as it relates to the discussion of organization is kind of thinking through this whole issue of critical groups. Now, remember, a critical group is a group of people that we perceive as being critical to our success. So a critical group, if we were involved in fundraising, let's say fundraising is an important initiative to which we are going to commit ourselves this year, you might say that a critical group would be our donors, people that are currently supporting us. Or you might say they might be major donors, people who we perceive for one reason or another to be capable of considering larger contributions. We may say foundation. That's a critical group because there are some charitable foundations that might choose to support organizations that have a profile similar to yours. So those would be critical groups. And they're critical because if our need is for funding, these people represent potential funding sources. Now, if you're getting ready to, you know, go into a recruitment campaign for students, then your critical groups change. Because you might be looking for Christians who come from a particular culture, as might be the case with the Eurasian Missionary College in Kazan, where Tim is ministering as a director of development. And you might say, well, we want to focus on this particular area of the world because it's close to Islamic-speaking or Islamic populations of people. There's an open door here, and there seems to be some evangelical activity here, so we'd like to find some people that come out of this particular area of the world because that's the next focus of our church planning initiative. And so recruitment now is identifying groups of people in that particular area who meet a certain profile. And so now we're going to determine, well, how can we bring them to the front porch? How can we bridge them? How can we expose them to the nature of our ministry? So critical groups always change. And they change based upon our need. But we need to identify critical groups. And you heard me say earlier this week is that it's easier to do development planning or to think strategically around groups than it is around individuals. If you have, in the case of Habitat for Humanity, 2 million people on your database, I mean, that's almost too overwhelming to even begin thinking, you know, that you could tackle that monster in terms of cultivating relationships with those 2 million people. But the realities are those 2 million people fall into, let's say, 200 groups. You've got businesses, and you've got churches, and you've got partner families, and you've got volunteers. They all fall into different groups, and it's a whole lot easier to strategize from a developmental standpoint around groups than it is around individuals. All right? We've already mentioned here the rules of 5 and the rules of linkage. Let's go to determining initiatives for critical groups. And, you know, basically, if you were to come up with 5 specific objectives or 5 particular focuses as it relates to critical groups, what 5 things would you want to do? Well, the best way to think through that is really to take in mind the planning model. Let's take, for example, Habitat for Humanity as an organization. And they're specifically identifying volunteers, people who've worked on a habitat project somewhere in the world, and they would like to enhance or strengthen their relationship with this group of people. So one of the questions that we would, theoretically ask them is, okay, if you had the perfect relationship with volunteers, people that came out to a work site, then what would it look like? I mean, how would you want a volunteer to look like who had experienced in totality the habitat experience? And you might say, well, we'd want them to know the breadth of our vision. We'd want them to know the breadth of opportunity in terms of involvement. In other words, you can do more than just pound nails in order to be a part, an integral part of what it is that Habitat is all about. We'd want them to be associated in a meaningful way with a local affiliate, because a lot of Habitat volunteers just kind of show up, and they may come from different towns depending upon the nature of the construction project that's being built. I was in Washington State not too long ago, and they were having what's called a blitz build. And there are people within the Habitat community who basically have motorhomes, and all they do is they just go around from blitz build to blitz build, and get involved in the project. So you have people from Kentucky and people from Florida and people from Nebraska and people from other places around the world that just kind of are Habitat junkies, they're just kind of looking for an opportunity to plug into something that they really believe in. So you might want to make sure that they're plugged into a local affiliate. You might want to let them know that they could serve as a Habitat representative, say, in their local church. So you could come up with, a kind of an ideal picture of how you'd see these people looking if they were totally and successfully integrated into the overall ministry of what it is you've committed yourself to do. Well, then you could grade yourself, couldn't you? You could say, well, are we an A as it relates to volunteer relationships, or are we a B, or are we a C? So grade yourself, assess, quantify deficiencies. Okay, well, why are we a C? Well, because the majority of them, are not involved in a local affiliate, or they're not involved in local churches. They're not doing anything outside the building experience. All right, well, if that's the case, prioritize those in terms of their relative importance, and then ask yourself the question, is there something that we could do to enhance them or to move them meaningfully forward into the relationship that we would desire to see them at? So you could do that with any group. You could do it with volunteers who assist in a crusade. You undoubtedly have a whole network of volunteers that are engaged in putting on or supporting as staff people, a successful campaign or a successful crusade. Well, what would we like the ideal volunteer to look like? What would we like everybody in the congregation, regardless of whether or not they respond in faith to the provisions of Christ, to look like? What would we want them to walk out of the room looking like? And again, all of those things enable you to be more proactive in what it is that you say, the bridges that you create, and, organizing. It might be that, we have a bunch of people at the crusade that are medical professionals, and they're going to come from all kinds of professions, and so we're going to have discussion groups in various places around the city, and we provide a listing of opportunities. If you want to be a part of a medical group discussion group that meets once every 6 weeks or fortnightly, then check here, and we'll make sure that you're given, material that will enable you to be a part of a, apologetic, you wouldn't probably want to call that apologetics to an unbeliever, but here we're going to create the kind of environment where we're going to discuss these issues, and if you'd like to be a part of it, then check here. Well, again, what it means is that person leaving doesn't look at this event as an end in itself, but if he has been touched by the Spirit of God and he's been moved in some meaningful way, it does provide them the opportunity of being able to plug in somewhere along the way and consequently or potentially being brought into a relationship of faith with Christ. So that's one way to do it, is to look at the critical groups, that would show up at a crusade, believers and unbelievers. and then try to figure out if there are ways of being able to bridge them more effectively and then to engage them as a group in cultivating relationships with them, recognizing that it's in the context of a relationship that real true change takes place. I'm hoping that I can say that well tonight. Richard Cunningham's going to interview me, and we're going to be talking about, you know, ongoing relationships we could have with organizations that are here at the forum. And what I really want to say is that, you know, we've heard wonderful things at the forum. We've grown in our understanding of the Lord. We've grown in our understanding of our ability to defend ourselves in the midst of, you know, give reason for the hope that's within us. We've been able to fine-tune, perhaps hone our theological understanding of critical issues that are certainly unique to the church and our ability to be able to fulfill mission. But the realities are, if we've not learned anything about how to take what it is that we have and apply it meaningfully or powerfully in the lives of people, you know, there's still something missing. And I think that's the relational aspect that development, or what it is that I'm trying to do, brings to the table. All right, number three, other factors to guide the determining of initiatives are two concepts that I'm just reminding you of, and you already know that. The first one is AID, A-I-D, which is a cultivation model, right? We talked about AID in terms of cultivation. A stands for attendance, I stands for involvement, and D stands for donation. So we talked to you in terms of cultivation that if somebody had attended something that you do, that's one thing. If they choose to become involved in some kind of a meaningful way, which means that you need to think of meaningful ways in which people could become involved, not just busy activities, as we used to call them when we were in school. You know, this is busy work. And, you know, you always hated teachers that, you know, couldn't find a better excuse to give you homework than just to do it because they were told to. And so they'd have you do something that was totally, you know, worthless in terms of bearing any kind of enduring fruit. We called it busy work where I was growing up. I don't know what they called it where you were growing up. But we need to think of creative ways in which we can engage people, that they could be meaningfully involved in what it is we do. And then donation, think of donation not just in terms of dollars, but in terms of commitment. People sacrificing something, you know, for your organization. In other words, you're asking them to make a commitment that costs them something. And it may be, you know, putting, you know, $10 or $20 or 20 pounds into an offering plate, but it might be something that, you know, demands that they take time from their work day and they go to a meeting place and they make a sacrifice of time to help you to fulfill some of the objectives or your mission, which goes a little bit beyond volunteerism, although volunteerism does involve some level of sacrifice, but it's a little bit more than that is what I'm thinking about. Well, if somebody had done all three of those, we'd say that they were an A prospect. And if they'd done two of the three, they'd be a B. If they'd done one of the three, they'd be a C. If they'd done none, a D. And the point is that exponentially, their likelihood of participating in a long-term basis on the basis of cultivation is somewhat predictable. D prospects, 0% likelihood for all practical purposes. C prospects, 30% likelihood that they'd say yes to us. Bs, 60. As, 90. And so it seems to me that as you're looking at groups and you're seeking to cultivate them and you're trying to determine what your five initiatives are going to be, at least AID ought to have some bearing on trying to determine what those five initiatives might be. It might be getting them someplace or providing them an involvement opportunity. And then the other model to keep in mind as it relates to trying to determine what these five initiatives should be would be the entry, bridging, and conversion model. In other words, if you have D prospects who've never been exposed to you, what kind of entry-level opportunities could we provide? And then more specifically, what kind of bridges could we create to move them from one level of involvement to another? In other words, getting them off the front porch, getting them into the family room, that kind of a analogy. Now, the model that we use is essentially a circular or a circle organizational chart. So it's nothing that's terribly profound. Although there is a certain level of profoundness, I believe, to the model because it's so easily manageable. I kind of think in terms of circles. When I'm getting ready to organize something, I just kind of draw a whole series of circles. I ask myself the question, well, if this activity is going to be successful, what groups need to be involved? And then I create the profile just kind of automatically and so forth and determine the objectives and so forth and then begin to plug names into this whole matrix here. So in the outside of the circle is basically the group or the activity that we're targeting. So let's call it the target group for the sake of illustration. And in this particular example, let's say it's churches. Let's say that this block represents First Baptist Church, and this one is Second Presbyterian, and this is St. John's Episcopal, and this one is Martin Luther Church, and so forth. I mean, we've got churches with different names, and each one of those churches are churches with whom we'd like to build a relationship, because we realize that it would be nice to have church relations, you know, people within congregations who really are committed to our ministry. So let's suggest, for the sake of illustration, that this year, one of the things that your ministry is going to commit itself to do is having church representatives in, let's say, 5 or 10 key churches. You may say 20 or 25 key churches. I mean, it really makes no difference, but what you're looking for is you're looking for someone who will kind of serve as a liaison, if you please, between your ministry and the church that they attend. And so in order to be able to do church church relations, you've decided on moving in this arena, that we want a church rep. We want somebody in those churches who will do and act on our behalf. Now, what could they do? What could a church rep do? Well, let me suggest to you 5 things that a church rep could do. Well, let's say that, you know, certainly most of your ministries have, you know, 10 or 15 churches with whom you have some level of relationship, and people within those congregations who have some level of affection for your ministry. So let's just say that you had 15 churches in this outside circle. All right, now let me suggest to you 5 things that a church rep could do. Well, one thing that they could do is they could identify influencers in that congregation. See, every church has movers and shakers in it. You know, influencers, people who kind of set the tone in terms of where the church is going to go. People look to these people for direction. When things happen, they're always obviously present. When things don't happen in a congregation, these people are kind of noticeably absent. You know who they are in your church. Give me a church directory of the place where I worship and a highlight pen in 10 minutes, and I could probably list all of them, you know, relatively quickly. I think it's important that you know who those people are. In fact, I'd like to know who the influencers of every evangelical church in America are, because it seems to me that if we're going to have impact on evangelical churches in America or around the world, then that's where impact's going to start, with the people who have the influence of setting the opinion and shaping the agenda of other people just by virtue of the roles that they play within their congregation. Now, we'll talk about what we'll do with these in just a few moments. A second thing that we might want these people to do is to make sure that literature about our ministry is readily available within that congregation. In other words, if you have a newsletter that comes out quarterly, then you might want to make sure that you know, your church representatives have a copy of that newsletter or a supply of those newsletters that they can place, you know, with the permission, obviously, of the pastor and the church leadership, that we can place in a place where people might be able to pick them up to learn more about what it is that the Lord's doing. In fact, you might want to put /announcements. In other words, there may be special announcements that occur during the year that you'd like to get into a church bulletin. Let's say that Ravi Zacharias is making a trip to the area, and nobody expected that, but he's made himself available for a debate at the local college campus, and we want to have, you know, people within congregations extended the opportunity to come along. So how would you get that information out? Well, you might go to the church representative with a bulletin squib, okay? A little squib that could be put into a church bulletin. They could take it to the church secretary and say, well, if we have any space in the church bulletin this week, here's an announcement in relationship to Ravi's forthcoming visit to the area, and maybe you could put it in. Notice how linkage plays into this, because now it's not me as the executive director of the organization going to the church secretary. It's somebody from the congregation going to the church secretary, someone with whom they are in relationship, asking them if they might be able to help us in getting the word out in relationship to this incredible opportunity. Number three, you might want to, use the church rep to make follow-up phone calls. Now, again, this is depending upon the nature of your ministry, but let's assume that your ministry gets phone calls periodically from people in certain areas of the country, and so you're talking to them. They say, well, can you send us some information about things that will be coming up? And you say, yes, we'd be happy to do that. And so you get their name and address, and you say, oh, by the way, are you attending a church locally? And they say, yeah, we happen to be attending Second Presbyterian. Oh, well, we've got a church rep, in Second Presbyterian. Let me have them, too. I'll give you their number, and I'll give them your number if you don't mind, and maybe you can kind of interact a little bit about some of the opportunities that are available in our ministry right now. And so you get off the phone, you call this person. This person, because they go to the same church, again, it's the linkage issue, it makes that encounter a whole lot more powerful. Fourthly, you might want to set up a meeting in the church this year where you or someone from your organization could come and speak on behalf of what it is that you do. Maybe it's a church service where you preach, but it might be that you request the opportunity if a church service wouldn't open up to speak to a Sunday school class or to a small group or a group that you would recognize as being the kind of group that might have an interest, an ongoing interest in supporting some of the things that you're doing. Maybe it's a college group, and so you want to talk to the college kids, and so here's a way that you can be involved in what it is we're doing, and so you go and you talk to them. So setting up a meeting could be helpful. And then I think fifthly, what we've recommended to a lot of organizations is looking to the church rep to schedule a reception. Sue and I were asked to do this recently. We're supporters of the Central Indiana Crisis Pregnancy Center. It's an organization that helps young ladies deal with crisis situations they may find themselves in an unexpected pregnancy. And it's an organization that really encourages them to keep the baby rather than to abort it. We really believe in the organization, and they're going into a capital funding campaign. And in fact, they're in the middle of one. And the executive director of that organization called me up the other day, and he said, now, Jerry, he says, would you and Sue be willing to open up your home for a reception for people from your church? He says, I'm not asking you to invite the people. I'm just asking you if you'd be willing to open up your home. And I said, what did you want us to do? And he says, well, if you'd make ice cream. Now, I make good ice cream. I'm kind of known for my ice cream. So if you ever come to Indianapolis, I'll whip you up some ice cream, and it'll be the best you've ever eaten. And so I said, sure, we'd be more than happy to do that. So we open up our house. We make coffee, and I make some ice cream. And somebody else was being asked to invite people from the church to come over to Jerry's for an ice cream social. Well, that's kind of a big thing. People usually respond to those invitations because they like my ice cream. And it's always usually a fun time. So here we have 40 or 50 people, hanging around the house. And, Dan Steiner comes on behalf of the organization. He's the executive director, and he makes a presentation on behalf of the Pregnancy Center and shares with us what it is that the Lord's doing. Okay, so wouldn't it be something if you had a reception, somebody in one of these congregations was willing to open up their home? Maybe you invite all these influencers along with other people to come to that reception. Very informal time. You're not going to ask them for money. Remind people from the very beginning, this isn't a fundraiser. But it provides you the opportunity of interacting with them, maybe asking the question, are there ways that you might be able to think that we might have a stronger presence in your church or in your community, and seek their input and their advice and try to make them partners with you. Here are some ways that you could plug in. And if you've promised them that you're not going to ask for money, then don't ask for money, but still bridge them if, in fact, they have an interest in becoming more involved in what it is you're doing. So there's five things that you could do. Now, one of the things that I pointed out in our forum this morning, there are two typical reasons why we find it difficult to get volunteers. And most of you know this, at least intuitively. One reason why we find it difficult to get volunteers is we're kind of ambiguous in terms of what it is we ask them to do. We say, well, will you be a church rep? And they say, what do you mean, a church rep? Well, would you be willing to serve as a liaison between our organization and your church? And He said, yeah, I'd be willing to do that. So you say, thanks, and you kind of walk away. They said, well, hold it. What do you want me to do as a church rep? Well, I don't know. I mean, be a liaison. You figure it out. Well, that's pretty frustrating for most people because most people are looking for more structure than that. In fact, if you're asking a perfectionist, which oftentimes you will, you've created an instant stress situation. You know, the most stressed people in the world are perfectionists. And the reason that they're most stressed people in the world is because they never achieve perfection. So they're always, you know, setting a goal that's higher than their ability to be able to attain, and so they're always feeling some level of stress. Well, if you ask a perfectionist to do something and you don't tell them what to do, then instantly, you know, you create stress for them. Now, they may do it once, but it's highly unlikely that they'll ever do it again. You can always tell if you've gone too far with people is when you find yourself walking down a hallway at church and you notice people diving into closets and restrooms and empty classrooms just to avoid seeing you because they're afraid you're going to ask them to do something else. So one thing that we need to do is we need to be quite precise in what it is we tell people we want them to do if we're seeking to engage them as volunteers. A second thing or a second reason why people don't choose the volunteers because they're afraid to, because they think it's kind of an eternal yes. In other words, if I say yes to Michael, I am hooked for the rest of my life because there's just no way he's ever going to let go of me. So I think the two best ways to get volunteers is, number one, tell them precisely what you want them to do and put a time frame. You know, this is a relationship that we'd like to do, or this is something we'd like you to do for a period of time beginning in September, let's say, and going to the end of May. Well, if that was the case, let's go back to these five things. You know, if you were looking at a period of 1 year, and let's say a year, thinking more fiscal year than, you know, 12-month or calendar year, let's say that we were asking church reps to serve from, say, November 1st, which is, you know, in most of our cultures, I think here, you know, if you're down in New Zealand or Australia, it changes a little bit, but let's say here in the Northern Hemisphere that from September 1st until June 1st, which is the time where most schools are in session and we tend to live a little bit more organized and rigid existence, we're looking at that period of time and we're going to ask ourselves a question, within that period of time, how long would it take to do all of these things? Well, I think most of you would say, well, to identify influencers, that might take me, you know, 30 minutes. It's not going to take me very long because I've been going to this church forever and ever, and, you know, give me a highlight pen and a, you know, a church directory and, you know, a cup of cappuccino and I'll have it done in 20 minutes. Literature and announcements. Let's say you have four quarterly newsletters, and so you need to make sure that those are put out, and special announcements or bulletins. You know, let's say that takes a little bit of time. You need to do it over a year, so let's say that takes an hour. That means somebody delivers them to you, you take them to church and put them out. I mean, that would be a long hour, you know, unless you have a really huge church and you're putting them out at maybe two or three different locations. Follow-up phone calls, let's say that takes an hour. It may not be at all, because if you don't get any calls from that particular congregation, that would be somewhat of a irrelevant assignment. You might want to evaluate whether or not that's even worth including in the first place. Setting up a meeting, probably about 30 minutes. Setting up a foundation, or a reception, probably about 30 minutes. Remember, you're not planning the reception. All you're doing, you know, is scheduling it. So you total that up, you've got three and a half hours. So now you go to someone and they say, would you be a church rep? Yeah, I'd consider that. What is it that the church rep does? Well, these are the five things we'd like you to do this year. Well, how long is it going to take me to do those? Well, we've done a little bit of calculation. We think you could probably do it in less than 5 hours, you know, over this whole period of time from September 1st to June 1st. Well, if you ever have an opportunity to get somebody, you know, the opportunity is probably going to be there. Because that's not that much of a commitment for anyone to make. But it does involve people. And involvement in and of itself, the people that are your church reps are being cultivated just by virtue of the fact that you've given them a job to do. You've given them something meaningful to do that's moving your organization and growing its understanding and its appreciation deeper in the hearts and minds of people that worship in your church. Well, let's say that you had 10... Erase those here, or these. We have 10 churches, let's say, that we identify. So here's 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Oh, that's about right. And each one of these churches has a name. Okay, this is St. John's, all right? You're going to divide this by 5. So you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So we've got one more than we need here. All right. Now, in this circle here, we have a name. This is, let's say, this is Jill, and this is Jack. And in the middle, we have Sally. Now, Sally is someone that you would appoint organizationally. You say, Sally, this is what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to head up our church program for this year. What does it mean? Well, I've identified 10 churches that I think we ought to have someone who represents us as a liaison in that congregation and, you know, acts on our behalf in representing us to people who go to that congregation. And here are the 10 churches. And here's the way I'd like to organize it. And so you identify these 10 churches in the outside circle. And what you need to look for, Sally, is you need to look for two people that could help you. And this is what these people would do. They'd make sure that this information was received at a time-appropriate way, that these meetings were scheduled at a certain time. You know, we'd like to have all of our meetings scheduled by, let's say, December 15th. We'd like to have all of our receptions scheduled no later than February the 1st. We'd like to have all these influencers' names in by, say, November the 1st. And, of course, literature and announcements, we know when they're going to come out, at least on a quarterly basis. We're going to get newsletters or whatever the case might be, and they just need to be made available in the churches. So what these people will do, they will first of all be recruited by Sally, so you don't take on that responsibility. And there's a reason for that, by the way, because Sally will always pick people that she can work with, okay? We tend to gravitate to people that we're comfortable with, and that's a whole lot better than assigning, you know, people that you may not know, and because you don't know them, you don't have the freedom or you don't accept necessarily the challenge to be real proactive in pursuing them. So Sally picks Jack and Jill, and you, she says, Jack, these are the 5 churches, and you need to find somebody that in those congregations. And you might even ask Jack, you may show him the list of 10 churches, depending upon whether or not it's local, which it probably will be in most instances, and say, well, do you, which of those 10 churches would you take or like to take? Well, Jack says, well, I would probably take these 5 because I know these churches. I know the pastors of the churches, and I know people in those churches. And so, again, he's going to work in his area, his comfort zone as well. Now, what happens at the end of the year? Well, 5 things are accomplished in 10 churches. So 50 significant, meaningful activities are accomplished in each of those congregations. And you have cultivated 16 relationships, because you've engaged 16 people in a meaningful activity to help your ministry go forward. That's not insignificant, especially if you combine it with, say, some other circles. So we've got a church circle, but you say, well, there's some other areas that we really would like to develop this year in our development program. One is that we'd like to build a relationship with some major donors. And we'd like to build some other relationships with some foundations. And we'd like to build some relationships with some senior citizens. And those that are involved in campus ministries. And so let's say that you have 5 circles. And in these 5 circles, this is the one with major donors. And you've identified 25 people, let's say, that you feel have the capability and might have the interest in supporting, you know, our ministry by making a major contribution, say, of $1,000 or more this year to our ministry. Okay, here are 4 foundations that we've identified as having supported organizations with a profile similar to ours, and we have some linkage with those foundations because Ravi knows the directors of 3 of them, and the other one is very actively involved in an area where we're going to have a crusade this year, or where we have a campus ministry planned, a significant outreach ministry planned. Then over here you have, I don't know what we were doing over here, senior citizens. We've identified 10 or 15 senior citizens that we feel could make a contribution in some way to the nature of our ministry. And then over here we've got the college age crowd, or we've identified maybe 10 or 15 youth pastors or college-age pastors that are working with just college-age students in their particular congregation, so you want to build relationships with them. Oh, by the way, we're going to do a banquet this year, so we're going to have a circle for that. Now, in the outside circle of an event, like a banquet, you have what? You have setup, you have cleanup, you have public relations, you have program. I mean, there's all kinds of activities, and so you have somebody in the outside circle, for example, who is, you know, this is Bob, and this is Bill, and this is Andy, and this is Andrea, and this is Amber, and each one of these people have the responsibility for one aspect of the planning of that event, you know, like planning, setup, menu, those kinds of things. And then you have Joyce here in the middle of the circle, who's your banquet coordinator this year. So you can use these circles for events, for people, and for groups. And in each case, what it is that you're responsible for as the leader of your development program, for lack of a better term, is to profile what you want to happen in conjunction with each of these groups or each of these events, determine the objectives that you would like to accomplish, and recruit these center circle people, and that's all. You recruit those center circle people. I shouldn't say that's all, because you recruit them, and then you pour your life into them. You know, I'm going to, let's say that I've got, all these people, Joyce, and we'll put some names in here. Here's Bob, and here's Ann, here's Mike, and here's Jim, okay? So it might be, if you're looking at it from strictly an organizational structure standpoint, that Jim, Mike, Ann, Bob, and Joyce are my development committee this year. This is the committee that I'm working with. My development committee. And I try, or I make an effort monthly to either talk to them by phone or to bring, you know, sit down with them for coffee or bring them together as a group. But there's some kind of meaningful contact that I commit myself to as the executive director or the leading, you know, person, you know, within this organization. In making sure that these people are moving forward in what it is that we've committed ourselves to do. And let's say, for the sake of illustration, that we've got, you know, 20 people here. That might be 15, 5, and or let's say we had 31 people. Let's say we have 25 major donors identified, 5 people here, and 1. So in this circle, we have a total of 31 people that are engaged in helping us, involved. In this circle, let's say we have 5. In this circle, let's say we have 10. In this circle, we have 20. In this circle, we have, you know, 15. Well, here you've got 35, 45, 50, 81 people this year with whom you have cultivated a relationship. And if you've done 5 things in conjunction with each one of these circles, you've accomplished 25 meaningful things, you know, in conjunction with, you know, these 5 groups or these 5 activities to which you've committed yourself. That's not insignificant. And what it does is it preserves you for ministry. Focusing on people, which is really what it is all you're all about, and these people are building relationships with these people, and these people are building relationships with these people. Relationships are being built, you know, while at the same time ministry is being accomplished, while at the same time you are increasing the cultivation levels of everybody involved. A few days ago, we went through the process of identifying. Remember, we did the giving chart. You know, we were identifying how many donors we might need, and how many prospects we might need in order to have a successful funding project, be it an annual fund or a capital fund. And I said that you know, in this scenario, in this model that I laid out, you would need 381 qualified prospects and 127 actual donors to have a successful annual fund campaign or a capital fund campaign. That's what you would need in that particular scenario. So oftentimes the question is asked, well, where do we get the 381 prospects, qualified prospects? Well, in this particular example, we already got 81 of them right here. Okay, these people are at least B's, where maybe before they ever started the process, they were D's. So exponentially, there's a pretty good likelihood that these 81 people, when given the opportunity, providing they are capable, would respond affirmatively, at least a 60% chance that they would respond affirmatively to our appeal to help. So while the work of ministry is getting done, there's also the work of development that's being accomplished. And I think a way that is certainly appropriate to the need of our organization. Now, one final thing, and we may actually finish on time today. Where Gene, she says he never finishes on time. You know, usually he's 10 minutes late, and we're always fighting for people for the, you know, the evaluation forms and so forth. But this is relating now to a little bit of my passion, because, and it relates a little bit to what it is I've already told you. You know, I think, you know, the reason we don't transform culture in the kind of meaningful ways that I think local churches ought to be impacting culture and individuals should be impacting culture. It's not because we don't have people. It's not because we don't have a redemptive message. It's not because we don't have infrastructure in local churches that are having meaningful impacts or have the potential for meaningful impact. I think the reason why we're not transforming culture in meaningful ways is because, you know, we don't have a plan. And I think tomorrow I'm going to be talking about this specifically in the post forum, but it seems to me that there are two mandates that the church is responsible for, and I may be a little bit simplistic here. I'm certainly not the theologian that many of you are, but it seems to me that there are two primary mandates that the church has. One is evangelism, you know, go into Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the earth, and, you know, go into all the world, preaching the gospel, discipling people, and so forth. It seems to me that that's a pretty significant mandate that Jesus gave to the church. And it seems to be another mandate of the church that seems to be very prominent in Paul's letter to the Ephesians, and that is to equip and train people for works of service, Ephesians 4:12 and whatever. Well, how well, you know, would you grade on a 1 to 10 scale your church as it relates to the fulfillment of those, you know, mandates? How well are we really reaching out to the community evangelistically and bringing people to Christ? And how well are we equipping people for the work of ministry and literally sending them out and guiding them and helping them and engaging them to reach out to the culture and or reach out to people and hence the culture? Well, I've been thinking a lot about that lately, and I've written a new book entitled Transforming Culture, The Church at Work in the World, and there's a new Bible study that's coming out this fall entitled the same, Transforming Culture, The Church at Work in the World, and it's a 13-week study guide designed for churches and small groups to utilize to kind of, you know, think through a plan of how we might be able to impact. But I was thinking about critical groups as I was sitting in church one Sunday morning. I go to a church, it's fairly large, about 1,000 people or so, and large by at least, you know, European standards. And I'm sitting in church, and somehow this thing about critical groups had kind of logged in my mind, and I just couldn't get it out of my mind. And so I'm kind of looking around. You know, the pastor's thinking I'm really engaged in the sermon because I'm writing things down on a sheet of paper. I suspect he thought I was taking notes. And so I'm just kind of looking around, and I'm saying to myself as I'm looking around the congregation, which group of people do I so closely or most closely relate to in my church? Because I'm in a number of critical groups. I'm a senior citizen. I'm a grandfather. I'm a father. I'm a business owner. I'm a homeowner. I mean, you could think of any number of groups, you know, that people belong to. But one of the best ways to determine what group you relate most closely to is, you know, who do you gravitate to if given a bunch of people sitting in or standing in the foyer, you know, and they're all having conversations, which one would you most likely go up to? And usually there's a group of people that you really relate to. Maybe it's the members of your small group, or maybe it's the members of, you know, the group that I kind of hang out with is a bunch of guys that are about my age that are in business. You know, we just kind of talk a lot. You know, we're sitting around the coffee table and we're sipping our coffee and chatting about, you know, our week and the things that we've done. Well, so I wrote on the top of my paper, working male seniors, okay? So that's the group that I most closely relate to in my church. You know, I'm working. You know, I don't tend to quit. I'm having too much fun doing what it is I'm doing. I'm a male, obviously, and I'm a senior citizen, at least by standards in our country. And so I'm a working male senior. Well, then as I was sitting in church, kind of looking around, I'm saying to myself, now, are there other working male seniors here? And I started writing them down. This is when I think I really impressed my pastor, because I'm sitting there diligently writing, and he's preaching away, and I have to ask for his forgiveness later. But anyway, I'm writing down names, and I came up with 60 names. 60 men, just as I was looking around, that met that same criteria. And I just filed the sheet of paper, you know, in the front of my Bible, and I went home. Well, a few weeks later, my pastor comes over to my house, and we're sitting here in my office, and we're having coffee together, which is something we do periodically. And I said, "Hey, Tom," I says, "I'd like to give you this sheet of paper," and I handed him the sheet of paper. I says, "Look at the names on this list." So he looks at the sheet of paper. He says, "Wow." He says, "That's quite a list." I says, "Yeah, it is, isn't it? They're pretty interesting names on there." He says, "Oh, yeah." He says, "That's a great group of people." And he asked me, you know, what was behind the list, and I told him. And then I asked him the profile question. Well, you know the profile question. And the profile question was, "Tom, if our church was 100% successful in impacting the lives of these men in the way that you feel these men need to be impacted, you know, what would they look like if we were successful as a church and really impacting their lives?" And it was really fun to listen to him. It really was, because he got he says, "Well, that's an interesting question." He kind of leans back in the big leather chair that's in my office and kind of closes his eye a little bit, and he stops. And then he says, "Well," he says, "you know, Jerry," he says, "they would be men of integrity." He says, "I've just seen too many men that, you know, at a point in their lives, they just kind of lose it. They make a bad decision or something, and all the things that they've built their life upon, you know, kind of, you know, come to naught because, you know, of a bad decision." He said, "I just really would like to see them be real men of integrity, spiritual integrity and moral integrity and ethical integrity." And then he went on to say, he says, "if there's 60 men of this age in our church," he says, "I bet you there's 60 men right under them, young men, you know, 30 and 40 years old, who are in the same professions that these guys are in that, you know, probably will be following in their footsteps in many respects." He says, "I'd like to see these men mentoring these younger men." And then he said something about worldview. He says, "You know, I'd like them to have a clear understanding of a biblical worldview, and I'd like to see evidences of that understanding reflected in what it is they do in their family, what it is they do in the community, what it is they do in the church, what it is that they do in varying relationships, you know, that they find themselves." So he came up with, you know, three or four things. So here's what I did. Now, I want you to watch this, because I just think this is just terribly exciting. And, you know, this is what you may say that, you know, development directors, it doesn't take much to get them terribly excited about something. But this, to me, is terribly exciting. What we did, because of the size of the group, I never recommend that you go more than 25 in this outside circle. So what we did is we came up with two circles of 25. So 25, 5, we divided that. So each one of these had 31 names in it, all right? You get it? 25 here, outside, 5 people for every 5 to make sure that these things are getting done, 1 person in the middle. Well, these are the 5 objectives to which we've committed ourselves to this year. One is creating an accountability structure. In other words, we wanted every one of these men, and by the way, your participation in this was strictly voluntary. We just shared with men, "Here's what it is we'd like to do this year. Would you like to be a part of it?" And interestingly enough, I think everybody said yes. Because, I mean, it was such a challenging, I think, approach in terms of what it could mean to us, you know, if it was as successful as we hoped it would be. So we set an accountability structure. We'd like to have, you know, every one of these men have another man to whom they hold themselves accountable spiritually. Mentoring relationship. We wanted them to have a relationship with a younger man. Thirdly, we had a Bible study We actually have a guy in our church that's writing a 32-week Bible study guide, which takes about an hour a week to do. And the first 21 weeks are in developing a biblical worldview, and the last 10 weeks are applying it to every area of your life. It's kind of an interesting little Bible study, which doesn't take a long time, but it really is profound in terms of what it is that it's intending to accomplish. Number four, we have quarterly breakfast meetings. We get together for breakfast once a quarter, and then there's a men's retreat that we're very committed as a group of men to go into, because it's kind of a cross-generational thing in our church. You know, men from 13 years old to 95 come to this, and we really feel that we have a role, an important role to play. Now, quite frankly, one of the things that we did was we went back and we profiled the perfect accountability relationship, which was important for us to do, because I don't know if you've ever been in an accountability relationship with somebody else, but they can be a little awkward. Because you kind of, you know what you're here to do. So Michael's my new accountability partner. We go out to breakfast and says, "Hey, Michael, did you sin this week?" "Yeah, that's not good, Michael." You know, he says, "Well, did you sin?" "Yeah, I did too." He says, "Well, that's not good, Jerry." So we just kind of pray, And what it is that you're kind of hoping that this relationship is going to be kind of loses something because we're not really sure how to deal with it, to our both of our satisfaction and to address both of our needs. So we actually came up with a covenant, an accountability covenant. What does the perfect accountability relationship look like? What kinds of questions do we commit to ask to one another? What kind of relationship do we promise to have in terms of honesty and so forth and forthrightness and what, so it's just something that at the very first meeting we kind of look at, we discuss, we make sure that the parameters are pretty clear and we know what it is that we can do and what it is that we should be doing. We both sign it. It's a commitment before the Lord and one another that we really want to fulfill this in meeting on a regular basis and hold ourselves accountable before God to do what it is that we know we should be doing as brothers in Christ. Same way with a mentoring relationship. What's the perfect mentoring relationship look like? As we sat down and produced this Bible study, we're in the process of doing it. What's the perfect Bible study look like? What will it lead to in terms of end results? What's the perfect quarterly breakfast look like? So it's not just, come on over to Jerry's house and have a bagel and a cup of coffee and a good laugh and, a pat on the back. But it's really something meaningful that's helping us to accomplish the ultimate objective of what it is we want to accomplish in this relationship in the same way with what is the perfect participation in the men's retreat look like. Now we've got Bill here in the middle. We've got five guys here. We've got 25 guys out here. Let me tell you something about these guys. The only thing that those guys do is make 4 phone calls a year. That's all that they do. And those 4 phone calls a year are basically timed, early on. Have you met with your accountability partner? Did you get your covenants? Is everything, that you have needed? Did you have your first meeting? Is everything going all right? Have you, met with this person yet? And basically, it's just monitoring, by the way, mark this date. The next quarterly breakfast is going to be at Jerry's house on July 15th, and it's going to be at 6:30 in the morning, so put it in your calendar to get there and so forth. Well, let me tell you, after a year of doing this, we've got 60 guys that are growing deeper and deeper and deeper in their relationship with Jesus Christ. And these guys are becoming vital. I mean, they're really becoming there's a vitality in their spiritual life that's something it's really wonderful to behold. Well, you know what happened? The working male senior wives are thinking, "Well, we're left out. We want to have our group." The college age kids, "Well, we want to have our group." And the teenagers, the high schoolers are saying, "Well, we want to have our group." And the single parents are saying, "We want to have our group." And everybody. I mean, there's all kinds of groups that are saying, "Well, we want to have our group." And we're hoping that within the next 5 years, that we have 15 or 20 of these groups happening simultaneously every year. Well, stop and think about that. 20 groups of people, 5 things being accomplished in conjunction with every one of them, moving them closer in relationship to the ideal relationship that we would long to have them, equipping them for works of ministry, and so forth. Imagine, the difference that that's going to make. And just maybe we might have an impact in preparing these people for works of ministry so that, in fact, culture is being changed. Well, not only did we do this, And by the way, what's Tom do and the pastoral staff? They're in the center circles. You know, they're sitting down having coffee at Starbucks and, you know, talking to these center circle guys, just, you know, sharing the vision, you know, sharing the passion, praying about things, you know, that come to mind through these phone calls and so forth, and making sure that we're staying on top of things. So there's meaningful things happening. Tom's life is a whole lot easier. I think he would testify to the fact that life is a whole lot, you know, less stressful for him, you know, given the fact that now he's focusing his attention on maybe 10 people rather than, you know, 100 people. Well, what's happening externally? This is internally what's happening within the church, but externally the same thing is happening. Because what we've challenged people to do is to look at their world. So we have a lot of physicians in our church. Well, we said, you know, we're just going to trust God to use us to try to bring some physicians, people in the medical community, to Christ. We've got a lot of lawyers. We're just going to trust that God's going to use us to really have an impact on those people in our congregation. We have a lot, in our community. We have a lot of people that are involved in service clubs, a lot of people that live in neighborhoods, and we're challenging them to claim their neighborhoods for Christ. Well, you know, it just might be that in the providence of God, God might use us to impact culture. Why? Because our theology's improved? No, I think we probably had great theology and great preaching and great Bible teaching before. But what is different? We've got a plan. And we've got an organizational structure that facilitates the plan, that's easy to manage and functional in terms of its results. And my passion is, you know, maybe by God's grace, we really can make a difference. You know, our lunch meeting over with my friend today, we were talking about, you know, the homosexual agenda and so forth. You know, how has it been possible for them to make the kind of inroads culturally that they've made in terms of, you know, changing attitudes towards, you know, in the mass population as it relates to something that, you know, if we were to talk about 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, maybe even 5 or 10 years ago, who would have ever thought of even 10 years ago same-sex marriages being not only, you know, allowed, but actually encouraged to become focal points of major U.S. and world magazines? Who would have thought about that? There's got to be a plan behind it somewhere. And if Satan can do it, why in the world can't we do a better job at doing the things that we need to be doing and impacting culture in the way that God, you know, has told us we need to be, you know, doing or should be doing? So anyway, Gene's going to tell you to fill out your evaluation form, say nice things, because I'd love to come back to Chopron next year. But it's really been fun having you here. I don't know if I'll see you tomorrow or not, but if I don't, then thanks for being a part of my life and my ministry experience. It's such a joy to be able to be here, and I think this has been a great week for me. I hope it's been a great week for you as well. Thanks so much, and the Lord bless you.